This is the Education Gadfly Show.
A rare mistake on by Checker Finn. I couldn't
thousands
help but nail
of years,
you
prehistory, Neanderthal schools.
Yes, based on how well you could draw on the cave walls.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn.
Yikes, you mean I'm doing this again?
You are back.
Whoa, it's cold here.
It is cold in the studio, you're right. We you know, we can't use anything like heat in here because it creates bad sound effects.
And Pamela might melt.
Yes, that too. But it's just the hot air that goes on instead.
Hot air, we have plenty of that.
Yes. All right, lots going on here. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
New York City is trying to counter the influence of test preparation companies with regards to their gifted and talented admissions test. Is test preparation fair play in a competitive market, or is it an unfair advantage?
So, Checker, my understanding is that the number of kids who are qualifying for gifted programs in New York is soaring, and yet they don't have the slots for them. And the worry is that affluent parents are using test prep programs to help their kids get into these competitive programs.
Remember, we're talking here about elementary schools and middle schools. We are talking about little kids, test prep, little kids.
Four-year-olds.
Often four-year-olds and five-year-olds. The reason the number of applicants is soaring is not just because New York is, of course, breeding more and more smart kids. It's actually partly because of the test prep world, which is producing more and more kids who appear to be qualified for the gifted programs on the basis of the tests that New York has been using. And because those are regarded as vulnerable to corporate, for-profit, parent-financed test prep, the city's been trying to sort of finagle its way out of this by coming up with something they would regard as fairer to poor families. What's truly bizarre here, aside from the obvious policy point you made, Mike, which is there is not nearly enough space for the families and kids that would like it, what's truly bizarre here is that they're moving back towards something much closer to IQ tests, tests of native ability, rather than the things that turn up on the sorts of tests they've been using.
You know, this is kind of a slippery slope, it seems like to me, in that you look at what happens in France now, for example, where the French president says, well, we shouldn't allow homework because affluent kids have an advantage when it comes to doing homework at home. You know, how far do you go in trying to level this playing field? You know, it is possible that, look, test prep at 4 years old, we all would say is a problem. But, you know, several years later, when you talk about kids getting to Stuyvesant, you know, some of that is because of cram schools. And is that test prep or is that just kids who are learning more and are more prepared to do the high level work that these schools are asking for?
Right. And these are public schools. So once you get in, it is free. These are not snitzy private schools, which New York and a lot of other cities also have a bunch of. And so the reason the competition is so stiff is because you actually get a high quality program for free once your kid gets into one of these schools. I think the correct answer is to level up, not level down. Right. If there are a lot of kids who qualify, create more opportunity places for them.
And let's be honest. One reason why more kids are qualifying is because New York City is breeding more rich kids that are going to public schools. I mean, we've got a lot more upper middle class families who are living in places like Brooklyn and parts of Harlem, and they're starting to use the public schools again. And so, you know, these increases are still measured by thousands, not tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands. And there are more kids coming in well prepared because they have the advantages that affluence provides. And so, and many of the other options are in schools that have an ideological opposition to any kind of ability grouping or tracking or that sort of thing. So there could be a huge gulf for many parents between a gifted program where their kid gets challenged and a regular program where they simply do not.
This also attests to the growing market in New York and other cities, both for more charter schools that might cater to such kids, and also, frankly, more private schools, such as the new Chris Whittle venture called Avenues, for families that really can't afford private schools. New York doesn't have enough space in its private schools either.
All right, the charter school point is a good segue to topic number two, Pamela.
Last week, Reuters contended that some charter schools built obstacles into their application processes in order to shake out unfit applicants. Should we be concerned?
Charter schools and their admissions process is going to be an endless topic on the Gadfly Show and every place else for the foreseeable future. It is crazy to think that every school in America is right for every child in America. Schools are supposed to be different from each other. They specialize. Some work better for some kids and others work better for other kids. If you're not musically talented, there is not much point in going to a music-centric charter school.
But Checker, you know, 20 years ago when charters started, people tried to explain how they were different from magnet schools, which were bigger and much bigger at the time. And they said, well, one big difference is that charter schools are non-selective. They are open to everybody. And if there are more kids that want in than you have space for, you have to use a random lottery to determine who gets in. And there's a lot of people in the charter movement who still say that is essential to the ideology of what makes a charter school a charter school. Now, this reporter found examples where charter schools were flouting that. In many cases, it sounds like breaking the law. And there's been some push, you know, some outcry from charter supporters saying that's wrong and we should keep that from happening. But are you implying that we should allow charter schools to be selective?
Darn right. And I think they should specialize in, some should specialize in smart kids. Some should specialize in violin players. Some should specialize in disabled kids. Some should specialize in left-handed kids. Some should specialize in kids that really adore baseball. It's just fine. Schools are supposed to be different from each other. And the charter school ideology needs an update, and so do those charter laws.
But then doesn't that turn that into parental choice, into school choice, in terms of these schools choose the kids? And so it becomes inherently unfair. The charter schools get an advantage. They cream the best kids, and the public schools are left with everybody else.
You're doing your characteristically good job of being the devil's advocate, but in this case, the devil does not have a strong case. Schools have been picking kids around America for 1,000 years, and they will always continue to.
Does that mean back in Native American times as well? Is that what you're saying?
Native American times, all those schools, they picked which tribe you were from. And if they didn't like you, if you were a Sioux and they were an Apache school, forget about it.
All right. I just couldn't help get a rare mistake on by Checker Finn. I couldn't
thousands
help but nail you on that one.
Thousands of years, prehistory.
All right.
Neanderthal schools.
Yes, based on how well you could draw on the cave walls. Okay, topic number three.
On Tuesday, the congressionally mandated Equity and Excellence Commission released a blueprint for addressing disparities in educational opportunities. Is this news?
If it was 1972, maybe. Checker, didn't you come out with some report like this when you were in the Nixon administration?
Darn right. This is old news. It doesn't mean that it's absolutely wrong, but it surely means that they are retreading the war on poverty territory from the mid-1960s. And I don't see that they're going anywhere very interesting.
All right. So the number one recommendation is to equalize school funding. This one's been around a long time. While we've made progress in spending money, you could call it progress. We spend a lot more than we used to. There's still huge inequities. Is this ever going to get fixed, Checker?
As long as we expect at least 40% of the funding to come from local sources, which is the pattern in America today, it cannot get fixed because localities have different degrees of wealth.
So should we just move to state funding? Would you support that?
I'm torn, frankly, but I'm more bullish about state funding than I am about the current mess. The problem with state funding is that it tends to take people's sense of control away from their school and their child's school. I think, however, that if you combined state funding with charter school-style governance, where everybody really controls what goes on in their school, even if the money comes from the state, I think you might possibly end up with the best of both worlds.
I mean, that has been a conservative argument, is to say that when districts have to come to voters for levies to increase their operational costs or to build new buildings, that is an important type of accountability.
But it would also be an important type of accountability if a school had to come to the parents of the school or even the elected board of governors of that school to approve its budget.
All right. We will see if they have any more success in the next 40 years with this one than they had in the previous.
I expect many of the same people will be around to come back 40 years from now with yet another report.
They are remarkably well preserved. Okay.
They are well preserved.
That is the end of
Neanderthals. They write on cave walls.
That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. This is Amber's Research Minute, but today we have a special deliverer of the Research Minute, Dara Z. Handler. Welcome to the show, Dara.
Thank you. I will do my best to fill Amber's admirably big shoes.
Yes.
Although
and usually,
I didn't say that she had big feet.
No, but they are usually spiky shoes with big spikes.
And very stylish. I've
Absolutely.
Got zebra print shoes on today. Does that count?
It does, actually. That's pretty, that is Amber-esque.
Thanks.
All right. What you got for us this week?
I wish that I had Amber's accent, so try and project that as I tell you about an interesting little study by a group of student researchers in Binghamton, New York. They were actually in high school when they did this work, along with a professor at SUNY Binghamton, which, as a former high school teacher, I love. This group used a very hip methodology called social network analysis, which looks at a group of people and draws a map of the connections among them. Mm-hmm. Now, what they found isn't all that surprising. They saw that if a student's friends have a higher GPA than they do, that student's class rank was likely to go up over the course of a year. If a student's friend had a group of friends had a lower GPA than theirs, that student's rank was likely to go down, which isn't huge news. Any sociologist or teacher or parent could probably tell you the same thing. Kids are more likely to do what their friends do, whether that's doing homework or skipping class. And empirical studies in other fields see the same thing with obesity, emotions, and smoking. But this is the first empirical confirmation that peers do affect academic achievement over time. So it's a good start. And another interesting finding is that it's students' friends, not their best friends and not their acquaintances, that influence them the most, which could help us think about how we organize schools. So this work is a good start. Even if there are some questions about the rigor, the sample was only 158 students, which was most of the 11th grade at this one school. So the students knew everyone, not just their friend groups. And since it was only one school, it was pretty homogeneous, and we can't generalize the finding across different schools. But it would be really interesting to replicate this at more schools and looking at the way that peers affect students' achievement over time, seeing whether these effects are greater on low achievers with high achieving friends versus high achievers with low achieving friends. They could also compare students' social networks in real life with their social networks online. So if your friends are Facebook posting or tweeting about doing homework, does that mean that you're more likely to do homework and raise your academic achievement? So it's a neat little study, and it is a great start.
So this is fascinating, Dara. And I have to say, as a parent, of course, I pay attention to this. I mean, this has been well known for a long time. As a parent, you want to know who your kids' friends are. And, you know, helicopter parents are known to sometimes try to take an active role in making sure that your kids are picking friends that you approve of. But let me be very clear about this. I mean, we would all expect that kids who do well in school have friends who do well in school. Partly, let's say in a high school, they probably are in the same advanced classes together. But this is a little bit different. What you're looking at is change over time. That actually, say, getting to be friends with somebody can then who's high achieving can then change the trajectory of somebody's academic life.
Exactly. So the past work that's been done on this has all been static. And it tends to find that if you have friends who are people have friends who are like them. So we didn't know from those past studies if you're choosing friends with a high GPA because you have a high GPA, or if you choose friends with high GPA, are they likely to influence your GPA higher? And that's why a study like this that looks at change over time is really important.
You know, if Rick Hess were still co-hosting this on a regular basis, he would draw the analogy here that says, well, we've always known that hot women tend to have friends who are also hot women. I'm sure it works the same way for hot men who have friends who are hot men. People cluster with like-minded people. And so this is interesting that, you know, from a parent's perspective, I can understand how I can use this. It's harder to understand exactly what schools can do, because it seems like this is a little bit of a this is not necessarily a win-win situation here. I mean, if you have a spectrum of some kids are always going to be higher achieving than others, how do you think about managing this in a way that can help raise achievement of everyone? I don't understand how that math works.
I think that it speaks to the way that you organize your classes. So if you tend to segregate and do homogeneous ability groupings within your classes, we know that that does help student achievement, but what does that do for the low achievers? But perhaps by arranging a school situation where low achievers have exposure even to students who are higher achieving. Maybe they're not in the same advanced class as them, but they have the opportunity to form these peer groups and these friendship bonds that they're more likely to emulate the behavior of their high achieving peers, even if they're not in AP calculus with them.
This is kind of like the Breakfast Club, right? I mean, you want to find it. I mean, perhaps not with detention, but you know, a heterogeneous group of kids, and including some of the brainiacs, right?
And they all end up doing right in the end, right?
Exactly, with that great song that we all love, yes. And I see where this is going, though. Assigned seats in the lunchroom.
Or assigned seats in math class. As a teacher, I absolutely did that.
All right. Thank you, Dara. We look forward to Amber's return next week. But
as
Dara,
do I.
You did a very, very nice job with this. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
All right. As always, Checker, it's been a pleasure. Till next week.
I'm Checker Fenn.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.